Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly Extra, after an 18-month international group stage that just flew by. It's here, crunch time in the World Cup qualifiers. In danger, Argentina, Portugal, Sweden, and all sense of proportion over England's chances. Italy and Ireland, Germany and Russia, Sven and me in the England studio. Everywhere that desperate men come face to face, Football Weekly's there to preview it with our usual team of experts and a man we rang up in Denmark. Elsewhere, there's pre-game fights in nightclubs, a crowd of one. Paul Doyle presents the wacky Belgians. There's some good news for Portsmouth, and light at the end of the tunnel too for Sid Lowe. Back in range, we hope, on the road to Oviedo. All of that, plus your posts, and who Barry seen naked in Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Barry, Sean and Paul. Hello. I'm in a bit of a rush, actually. Producer Pete's got to get off. Hello, Sean.
Hello, James.
Yes. Paul?
Yes, hi,
Barry.
James.
Barry, great. Excellent. So much to cover today. And the big question, of course, first of all, is have you done enough prep, Sean? Because you were fretting about this.
I had about 20 minutes just charging through.
All right, what did you learn? What was the biggest fact you learned?
I was looking up the Odeon Cinema where they're showing the England-Ukraine game on...
You had to go and bring that up.
Well, there are a few towns across the country, Basingstoke, Bath, Lincoln. But what interests me was on the website, the film certificate is TBC, to be confirmed.
Right.
So I guess if Wayne Rooney starts Effingham Blind, it might be a 12.
There'll be people who don't understand what film you're talking about, Sean.
Well, it's the England-Ukraine game, and it's not being shown on domestic television in the UK. So you have a choice if you want to watch a game. You can either pay your internet subscription, which currently is $9.99, but will cost $11.99 on
Saturday. Has it gone up to $9.99?
It has.
Wow.
And you'll get to see England-Ukraine and also James and
Sven. That's not
all,
yeah. A whole half hour of me and Sven in the studio before the game kicks off.
People will be judging who's balder, who's more interesting, who's
right.
Better hit with the ladies.
Right. All those topics and more, I should think. Wow, it sounds more than worth $9.99.
But the other thing I think is interesting about the Odeon Cinema...
And you get a game for free as well for that price, do you?
Well, yes.
Right.
But with the Odeon Cinema, you know when you normally go in, they always search you for pick and mix and have you brought any sneaky drinks in the meantime. Do you think, can you imagine these... Well, that's what James Dart, who's a regular goer to watch rom-coms, was telling me earlier. Absolutely loves his rom-coms, but
don't think he does love his rom-coms. I think his wife loves her rom-coms and makes him go with her. See, I'm lucky. Mrs. Baz has her special. She's not really into rom-coms, but
right.
if there's some sort of chick flick she wants to see that I'm not going to be interested in, she has a chick flick, a female chick flick buddy that
all right.
they go along, so I don't have to go to them.
Oh, excellent. That's great news.
I've never seen Marley and Me.
No.
Nor do I
Paul,
want
you
to.
You chick flick person?
No, my wife likes horror movies.
Oh, nice so. One. Oh, nice one. What was the last horror movie you saw?
The Rob Zombie's remake of Halloween, I think.
Have you seen Drag Me to Hell?
I
urge you to go and see it. Fantastic film. Fantastic film. I tell you what, though, let's just get more or less back on point, because it could be a horror show, this one, for Ukraine. Big game for them. They could still get second place in the group. They're currently 2 points behind Croatia, but with a game in hand. And Ukraine are playing, of course, England, and then they're going to be away to Andorra, which you have to figure they might get some points in. So, big game for Ukraine, Andriy Shevchenko and all that?
It is. I mean, they've played England 3 times since independence in 1991, and they've lost every time, I think. There were friendlies in Wembley in 2000, St James's Park 2004, and obviously they play each other back in April. But Fabio has promised to play his strongest squad. As a betting proposition, I'm sort of staying well away from it.
Because you're in rehab.
Because I'm in rehab. But, I think it'll be a tough game for Ukraine. I think they'll struggle to win. I think you could easily see it being a grimy draw.
Any point of interest from England's point of view?
Well, partly I think the goalkeeping thing's quite interesting. Whether they'll go with David James or whether they'll pick Rob Green. And I think also just whether England can keep the momentum going. They've won 8 out of 8. They play Belarus on Wednesday, which you'd expect to win at Wembley. And I think if they can come, 10 out of 10 is also very impressive. It seems quite a few people didn't think they would get through the group.
I think it's quite interesting. Darren Bent wasn't called up to the squad.
Mm.
So that it seems an obvious inclusion for me. I follow him on Twitter. Oh. And
did he have anything to say about this?
Well, he just thanked everyone for their, you know, commiserating with him and not getting selected, but he didn't effing blind about it, like he has been known to do on Twitter.
Good. Well, that's England-Ukraine dealt with. Now, meantime, across the water in Dublin, Italy will be visiting Ireland, a bit of a get-together. You've got your Trapattoni and your Tardelli on one side, and your Lippi on the other, and somebody posting, and I failed to note down who it was, pointing out that if ever there was a congregation of coaches that was more guaranteed to generate a grinded-out 1-1 or 0-0 draw, it's this one. Big game for Italy, though. For Ireland, though, Barry.
Well, it's a big game for Ireland. They need to win to have any chance of topping the group, but even if they do win, they would need to hope that Italy don't pick up any points against Cyprus next week, which you'd have to say is very unlikely. There's also another big game. Cyprus are playing
Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm. So if Cyprus could take points off them, that would guarantee Ireland second place.
Right. Italy squad, more or less as you'd expect, no Cassano, and Marcello Lippi is now officially fed up of hearing about Cassano.
There's no Cannavaro either.
No, he's suspended. And there might be a slight tweak in formation with Gilardino on his own up front and Pirlo playing in the hole behind him and two
Does
wide.
Does the game really matter, though? Because, I mean, even,
the
if, even if Ireland lose, they're going to beat Montenegro at home. You'd imagine on Wednesday, Montenegro haven't won a game yet qualifying. And Italy, as Barry says, should take at least a point from their last game against Cyprus.
Let's move on then, Sean. Big, big world of World Cup qualifying. We'll talk about more of it right after this.
Football Weekly Extra on Guardian.co.uk.
Continuing our look at the wide world of World Cup qualifying, South America, Barry, the table, please.
At top of the table, we've got Brazil in 33, Paraguay in 30. They're both qualified. Then you've Chile on 27, Ecuador in 23, Argentina in fifth place, the playoff place on 22. And then beneath them, Uruguay and Venezuela on 21 each.
Only 1 point behind, and Uruguay is who Argentina will be visiting next Wednesday. They have disastrous away form, Sean Ingles, I'm sure you're aware. The last four away games, they've lost them all. They've conceded 10 goals in those games and only scored one in their last four away games. And before this game on Saturday night, they had home to Peru, which they should win, but you never know with Maradona. Maradona's only gone and said, I may quit.
I think if he did, I think the Argentina FA would be jumping up and down because they wouldn't have to give him a huge payoff. I hope Argentina qualify. I think it's not, you know, you want the big teams at the World Cup. I saw the Argentina team win the Olympics, different team, but you know, had several overage players, and they were sensationally good. Mm. You know, you looked at that team and thought, this team could do something in South Africa. I've seen them a few times since under Maradona, and they're clueless, they're awful, they're, you know, they're just abysmal, and you hope they would beat Peru and then set it up for Montevideo on Wednesday.
No, oh, that would be a huge game. I mean, the likelihood is that they're going to get through, at least in a playoff in which they would face, what is it, either Honduras or Costa Rica from the Central American group, which is currently being topped by USA with Mexico a point behind. But it is extraordinary. You mentioned the Olympic team. There's no question that they have the players. In fact, tweeting into your account, I see Patricia Wizach saying, Sean, your thoughts on Argentina squad, Zanetti, Cambiaso, Lopez all being left out. It is the stuff of madness.
And Milito, Diego Milito as well, doesn't
ever get
Diego
a look Milito, in. Yeah. He's injured at the moment.
Raquel May, you know, love him or hate him, you think he's surely a better player than Juan Verón, who seems to get a game lumbering around the midfield.
Pastore, they're big on Pastore as well. Yeah, all craziness. On that game, let's get back to Europe now. Group three, big game for Germany. You've just come back from Germany. I bet they were excited about this one, Sean. They're going to be away at the Luzhniki Stadium, where, of course, England came a cropper 2 years ago. There hasn't been an international match there on this plastic pitch since, I believe. The Russians 1 point behind Germany in Group three. What do you think is going to happen?
I fancy the Russians.
Do you?
I think at home, as you say, Luzhniki Stadium, the plastic pitch, I think they're quite a good price as well. I think I fancy them.
That puts Germany into the playoffs. Something we didn't mention when we were talking about Ireland is the fact that the FIFA playoff system may not favour them. Trapattoni calling it the death of football. What's the problem with the seeding system in the playoffs?
Well, FIFA said before the qualifiers started that it was going, in all probability, going to be an open draw for the second place teams in the European zone. And now he's moved the goalposts and said that it's going to be seeded, so which would say Ireland would be in the bottom four seeds, team like Germany or Russia would be in the top four. So it puts teams like Ireland at an unfair advantage. So Trapattoni and the Irish players obviously aren't very happy about that. I suppose the reasoning behind this was that it's beginning to look like some very good teams aren't going to qualify, and Blatter wants to give them as good a chance as he can to get to South Africa.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Ireland have been complaining about it, but hoping that, you know, they might get drawn against Latvia or someone if they make the playoffs rather than against Germany or France or somebody. But Ireland have only beaten Cyprus and Georgia so far. And beating Cyprus, Georgia and, say, Latvia shouldn't get you into the World Cup. I know that in the expanded European Championships, beating one team will be enough to get you in, but that is the death of football, in my opinion.
Now,
but it would be great to see playoffs, you know, a do or die clash between, say, France or Germany. Although FIFA would say, well, we'll see it in the World Cup if we contrive it so that they can all get there.
Yeah, well done, FIFA. Sounds much better. Okay, France set for second, as you hint there, behind Serbia. And Northern Ireland still have a chance. They have a huge game away to the Czechs.
I don't think they have a chance.
They have a chance.
I mean, even if they beat the Czechs.
That's the thing about Northern Ireland. They never have a chance, and yet they always succeed. World football's great overachievers.
Slovenia are in second place as well, and Slovenia have got to play San Marino on Wednesday, so they're going to win that. And they might get someone against Slovakia. So it would take a miracle of, you know, even if Ian Paisley got down on his knees and prayed to the great Protestant God in the sky, I'm sure it won't happen.
Right. Okay. If you're listening, Ian. Meantime, over in Group 1, crikey, it's tight. Denmark leading 3 points ahead of Sweden. Portugal and Hungary just behind them. Portugal are going to be playing Hungary. Sweden are in Denmark. First time they've visited since that infamous Euro 2008 qualifier when Christian Poulsen was sent off at the end of the game and the penalty for Denmark, who'd come back from 3-0 down, and then the referee. Well, on the line to tell us more about it is top Danish chum of the pod, Lars Eriksen. Lars, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Here with me, Paul Doyle, Barry Glendinning and Sean Ingle. And, well, first of all, an infamous game for us, and I'm sure for you Danish fans as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of become part of football history here, and it's obviously been the big elephant in the room in these weeks leading up to this game. It's hard to, you know, looking back on it, it was probably one of the greatest derby matches between Denmark and Sweden, and it also turned into one of the craziest ones. I mean, Denmark were 3-0 down after about 26 minutes, staged a remarkable comeback, and even had big chances to go up 4-3 in the end. And then, yeah, with 2 minutes to go, this fan runs onto the pitch and tries to hit the referee, and they end up losing. Yeah, he missed the ball thanks to the defender, Mikael Gaugo, who sort of got in between to soften the blow.
All right. Okay. Took one for the ref in this case. But anyway, magnificent stuff. Are they expecting a similarly highly charged encounter this time around?
Well, I mean, considering the last game was played in June and there was about a five-hour party in the nearby park with the live concerts and Carlsberg flowing in the streets, this time it's remarkably cooler in Copenhagen. So I don't know if people will be equally lubricated, but the signs are there for a fantastic game, and I'm sure we won't see scenes like that again.
All right, Denmark undefeated so far. Sweden, of course, have got lots of problems, especially with scoring. Let's see, they've drawn 0-0 twice with Portugal. They only beat Malta 1-0 with an own goal right at the end. They've got, is it the 38-year-old Larsen and Ibrahimovic up front for them? Is that a concern for Denmark particularly?
Henke Larsen is always going to be a concern. It looks like Elmander is going to be fit, so he might make the bench. And I think obviously there's a lot of stake for Sweden to make this tournament, because players like Olof Mellberg, Henrik Larsen, this will be the swan song if they make it to South Africa. So you always got to fear Henrik Larsen in any side, I think.
Lars, a lot of the newspapers in Portugal have been suggesting that there could be Scandinavian collusion, where they contrive to get a result that suits both teams. That to me doesn't make sense, firstly because I don't think a draw would suit Sweden in particular. But what are the football relationship like between the two countries? Is it quite a bitter rivalry, or would it be a more friendly one?
Well, as everything else in Scandinavia, it's always very friendly. I think during the 70s, the 60s, the Sweden-Denmark game was the biggest game of any football season. I think during maybe the later stages of the 70s, 80s, it lacked some of the excitement. I think what happened with that game in Copenhagen 2 years ago was that people feared they might damage the reputation of football. But actually, in the long term, it might just been the saving grace, because it's really ignited the atmosphere leading up to this game here and the one that was played in Sweden back in June.
Brilliant, Lars. Listen, one final thing. Denmark looking good then. Just need, 2 points really in these last two games against Sweden and then at home to Hungary on Wednesday. What about the Danish team? Assuming they do get to the World Cup, and then is it a good Danish lineup? Are folks there very excited about it and its prospects?
Well, people are particularly excited about the attacking prowess of Nicholas Bendtner, and as I'm sure most Liverpool fans are also crossing fingers that Daniel Agger will stay fit, because he seems to be the key part of the Danish defence.
Right, absolutely. Anyone else we should know about?
Thomas Sonsen.
Look out for the fan in row four. He might have a
top. Okay. All right. A word there to the referee in particular. Nice one. Excellent. Lars, thank you very much for that little window crucial match coming up on Saturday. Top Danish journalist Lars Eriksen. Now, more World Cup qualifying groups. Paul Doyle. Group 5, Spain, won it at a canter. Way back there in fourth place, Belgium. 7 points from 8 games.
Yeah, it's
what went wrong?
Everything that could go wrong basically went wrong. First of all, it is a difficult group, but Belgium have managed to make it a lot more difficult by sabotaging their own efforts to qualify. I mean, there's a whole host of problems within the camp. There's the rivalry between the Flemish and French-speaking players. There's a generation dispute between the older players and the young players, who are considered very cocky and don't take things very seriously at all. And then there was various sort of personality clashes within the team. So you've had things, for example, that after a 5-0 defeat to Spain, the players went out into a nightclub and a fight broke out. Before, the night before the qualifier in Sarajevo against Bosnia, players went out to a nightclub and didn't get in a fight, but didn't prepare in a particularly professional fashion. They even managed to lose to Armenia, one of the experienced players being dropped after turning up with no boots.
Did they not bring any boots with them?
He didn't, apparently.
No, but does the team not, does they not travel with any spare boots? Or was it a disciplinary measure?
I don't know.
If he'd been on the team I used to play on as a kid, he'd have been made play in his shoes.
Right.
He did go to a local sports shop in Yerevan and buy a pair of boots, but when he got there, apparently they were broken. I'm not too sure what that meant exactly.
Well, you wrote a fascinating piece about all this, which also included various experienced players asking the doctor to write them a sick note so they wouldn't have to turn up.
Well, it wasn't so much experienced players. Oh. He was making the point. This is a guy, a doctor, who had been the doctor of the national team for 26 years, and along with the entire medical staff, resigned after Frankie Verkouteren resigned in the defeat of Ghent in Armenia. That was the second Belgian manager to fall by the wayside during the campaign. And the doctor, he called the player, he said they have the sick mentality of childish snobs. And one of the examples he gave, he said, 10, 20 years ago, players would come to him and ask him to play down injuries so that they could still be selected. But now they were coming to him and asking him to concoct injuries so they could skip training and go womanizing. But the Federation hasn't covered itself in glory either, because Frankie Verkouteren, who was the number two, and then when the manager, Rennie van der Eyken, stepped down halfway through the campaign, Dick Advocaat had already signed a contract to become the manager. At the end of the campaign, and people said, okay, bring him in now, fast track that process, and they didn't. They appointed for Carter instead, and the media said, well, why did you do that? And they said, well, we weren't able to contact Advocaat, and a journalist right there and then rang up Advocaat and said, what's going on? They say they can't contact you. So Advocaat, he is taking charge of the match this weekend now against Turkey, and in his first press conference he berated his new employers, calling them liars and clowns and all the rest of it.
Quality. What's this about one fan turning up to a match?
Yeah, for the match, you know, I mean, the Belgian public has turned their back on the team, which is a real pity because they've got some really good young players, and it was supposed to be a return to past glories under these new players, but they don't have the attitude, apparently. So after bad defeats, particularly the back-to-back defeats to Bosnia and in Spain, they played Armenia, and one fan turned up. So in this section of the stadium set aside for the travelling fans, there was one guy.
I was at a wedding during the summer, a friend of mine, hello Raza if you're listening, and the bride and the bride's family were Belgian, and the DJ was playing a selection of top Belgian tunes, which makes me wonder why it is all these youngsters are eager to go nightclubbing and disco dancing, because I would rather be in the hotel room playing on my PlayStation or getting a good night's sleep than... you know, kicking out the jams to those kind of tunes.
Right.
But why the one... But, I mean, I've driven through Belgium quite recently on the way back from Germany. And
oh,
must
right.
Be the,
no idea. We should have come to you earlier.
But they must be some of the worst drivers in Europe, I think. We drive along...
Englishman complaining about continental drivers. Yes. I haven't heard that riff before.
Sort it out. The music... it's like driving skills.
In defense of Belgian music, Jacques Brel was Belgian. He's a
Plastic
genius.
Bertrand was also Belgian. And that whole Belgian
Johnny Halliday.
He's not Belgian.
I think he is.
Oh, there's no way he's a French institution.
I think he's Belgian.
Crikey.
Chocolate. They do good chocolate.
They do good chocolate. They do lots of good
credit
things
where
in Belgium.
Good
European players. Government, they handle that pretty nicely. Thank you, Belgium.
It does have a
Steve Malbronk. He's Belgian, although, like Halliday, often perceived as being French.
Wow. Another revelation on Football Weekly Extra. Exclusive.
They put on good. They give good rock festival as well. Rockverter is in Belgium.
Right, so okay, but good. Just don't drive there.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Belgium, Jipper?
Of course I've been to Belgium. Nothing wrong with it at all.
You better go because it may not exist for much longer.
There's some great art there as well. If you go, you go to Ghent and you go, obviously go to Brussels, there's some
lovely art, great food.
I wouldn't say great food.
There's some great food in Belgium.
Quality beer.
All right.
Nice monasteries. Nice monasteries.
I didn't have you down as a monastery man.
I love a good monastery. I went to school in one.
Well, there you go. Throwaway comment that we ought to hurry and go to Belgium because it might not be there much longer. You're not entirely joking when you say that, are you, Paul?
Well, no, there was real dangers of... particularly the Flemish part, seceding from the rest of the country, and splitters that they are. And it was only the credit crunch and the economic crisis that spurred a brief national and the question of what to do with Brussels, because that's something that's never been resolved. Which is quite ironic, considering Brussels is the heart of the European Union.
Yeah.
So
we might actually end up with a country called Wallonia.
Yeah.
The Marx Brothers would be happy with that one. Excellent. All right, well, good luck to Belgium, etc. Of course, as I mentioned, top of that group are Spain, and that means segue, that right after producer Pete presses play on the jingle machine, we can hear, we hope, from the long-awaited Dr. Lowe in Spain. Right, part three, and that means Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Yes, it does. Sid.
What was that big
yes
for?
Yes. It's a cry of relief, Sid. It's,
is it?
Yeah. It's so nice to hear your you know, dulcet tones and that. And I know I speak for listeners anyway, everywhere, rather.
Apologies for Monday. Yeah, well, I had a phone reception-related disaster on the train on the way back from Seville.
Hey, you know what? You can tell us all about it now with the benefit of a couple of extra days of stewing in the Real Madrid camp, because it is their first defeat after winning every single game so far. But I see there's already been a storm over the manager, Manuel Pellegrini.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible, this, isn't it? And Ramon Calderon was talking at the Spanish Football Federation yesterday because they're celebrating their centenary, and bizarrely, he's in charge of the celebrations. And he was saying, and as so often when Ramon Calderon speaks, of course, he's completely paranoid. He thinks everyone's got it in for him. But actually, a lot of what he says is true. And he said, the thing about Real Madrid is it's a club that crushes presidents and managers and really kind of chews them up and spits them out. And that's what's happening. One defeat after a run in which they'd won 7 out of 7, five out of five in the league, 2 out of 2 in the Champions League, scoring better than 3 goals a game. One defeat against Sevilla, a very, very good Sevilla side. and everybody's out for Pellegrini already. It's quite bizarre, and I think this is obviously one of Madrid's long-term problems, is that they have a kind of an entourage that surrounds the club, including the media and the fans and so on, that means the demands are just so high, and when you spend €254 million, then of course they're even higher.
Sid, I wanted to ask you, if I could, about Karim Benzema. Because I see he's gone through a strange mood at the moment. He's admitted that he finds it hard to try when he's playing for France. And he also had a pop at Lyon, saying that he was going stagnant there because of the lack of competition. And yet today I see that he's complaining about Raul's presence in Real Madrid and about the amount of competition he has there. What's wrong with the boy?
Well, I must admit, I'm starting to ask this question myself, and I have to confess that as early as this, I don't know a huge amount about him, and of course my judgments are based on what little I've seen of him so far. I don't know a huge amount about what happened at Olympic Lyonnais and how much of a player he was there, but there are certain things about his behaviour that I must say I'm not particularly impressed about. He does seem a tiny little bit moody. He does seem a little bit divorced from what's going on around him. The comment about Raul goes back to something he was asked not very long ago, and everybody of course jumped on this, because whenever anything is mentioned about Raul, it becomes a huge debate for those people who are defending Raul and also for those people who want to bury Raul. And one of the things he said is that he prefers to play with a real number nine, a Van Nistelrooy figure. And of course, in brackets, i.e. not Raul, is what everybody was thinking. And I think that that certainly seems to be the case so far. I think he's alternated very, very good performances with really quite bad ones. And it's also, I think, in the interest of fairness, worth pointing out that at the weekend against Sevilla, he wasted an absolute sitter, a complete air shot from a brilliant pass from Raul. And he does seem to be a little bit edgy emotionally. I suppose he's still very young. And I suppose as well, I mean, you obviously know this much better than me, that not feeling particularly motivated by France is perhaps not that surprising, because they do have a coach that the vast majority of players seem to think is a complete tit.
Mm. But as one blogger pointed out, some female fans are more than unhappy with. And in fact, just a quick clarification here, thanks to Invisible Paris for this. The woman who sang the Dominic love song is pronounced Ranger, not Ringer. She's better known in France being one half of Lerita Mitsuku rather than as an ex-porn star. Apparently, she did some very softcore stuff a long time ago.
Who hasn't, Jimbo, back in the day?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Sid, there's been a lot of talk here about how much Liverpool are missing Xavi Alonso, etc., etc., and so on. But what about there in Real? Is he having, you know, is his, given that his absence is causing Liverpool to fall apart, is his presence at Real Madrid not working wonders?
Not entirely. It's quite early to make a judgment on that. Certainly when you look back at the game against Zurich in the Champions League, Real Madrid were cruising that until he went off injured, and then they really fell apart for 10 or 15 minutes. Then, of course, they came back and they won 5-2 and scored a lot of goals. And bit by bit, I think, so he's probably playing a more important role for Real Madrid. And I think as the season progresses, he will play a very important role for them, because they're a side that are very good, as to use Jorge Valdano's words, very good in both areas, but maybe not that good in the middle of the pitch at the moment, where football is made, or at least this is Valdano's impression of it, that they're lacking a little bit of fluidity. And that, of course, will be Xavi Alonso's role. He then got injured, missed a couple of games, came back, and I think looked off the pace. He didn't play particularly well in his first game back. And against Sevilla, I have to say, I thought he was probably the weakest of Real Madrid's midfielders. Looked a little slow, was robbed of the ball a couple of times by, of all people, Didier Zakora. But I do think that as the season progresses, if Madrid are going to be a very good football team and not just a collection of very good footballers, then I do think he's going to be their key player.
Sid, that's all fascinating. And you're off to Real Oviedo this weekend, is that right?
I am, yeah. I'm going to Asturias for the big Asturias derby between Real Oviedo and Sporting Gijón.
Crikey.
However, as Oviedo fans probably don't really want to admit, it's actually against Sporting's B team. That's how far Oviedo have fallen. Mm. Biggest game of the season for them. It's against their local rivals, bunch of stiffs.
Yeah. Sid, you have to wear your builder's hat, because in previous derbies, isn't that a sort of thing that people do?
Yeah, the season, the first year that I lived in Oviedo, when I pointed out to some mates that I was going to go to the Oviedo Sporting Gijón derby in Gijón, supporting Real Oviedo, the first thing one of them said to me was, "Don't forget your builder's hat." And I thought this was the most bizarre reference I'd ever heard. I kind of imagined some sort of village people scenario going on. And it turns out it was actually very good advice, which I was foolish enough not to take, although I did wear a hoodie, which didn't actually help very much. Because what happens is you go on a train, it's like the old days, I suppose. You go on a train, all the fans together, arrive in Gijón, and the Gijón Stadium, the Molinón, is about a kilometre and a half, 2 kilometres from the station, along the seafront, and the police basically march you to the stadium. Now, of course, they march you to the stadium along a gauntlet of Gijón fans, chucking bottles and bricks and stuff at you all the way. So actually wearing a workman's helmet is not a bad idea at all. On this occasion, I suspect that probably won't be necessary. I certainly hope it won't be necessary.
My word. Sid, listen, best of luck. Keep that valued cranium well protected, and we will hopefully catch up with you next week.
Speak to you then.
All right, then. Good. Post. The oldest code, John Ashton. Did you get Emmeline's autograph or not? Well, sadly, John's not here to reveal that particular of his...
What did he sign it with?
Indeed. He was naked at the time when exactly. Young... Yeah, exactly.
Well, presumably, Asher's had a pen. It's poor autograph hunting etiquette to not have a pen.
That's true.
To give to the... And then the celebrity, whoever's signing your autograph book, steals it.
Right. Tell us about your naked celeb experience, Barry.
Yeah, they're not great, to be honest. I've seen you naked.
Have you?
Yeah. We were sharing our apartment in Vienna. Yes,
I remember.
I used to let myself into your room at night and sit at the end of your bed watching you sleep for hours.
All right.
But I've seen... See, I can't really say because I accidentally walked in on a top Irish rock artist once while he was naked in bed with a woman who wasn't his girlfriend.
What building did you walk in on them?
He was in my then girlfriend's spare room.
Oh, all right.
With another woman, my girlfriend's flatmate.
Right. What kind of rock artist? World saving, a hunger ending world?
He was very famous in Ireland in sort of the mid to late 90s. He's still going.
Was he a whimsical Irish rock artist?
He's slightly whimsical, yes.
All right, good.
And I've seen Andy McCluskey from Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark naked.
Okay.
That's pretty low rent.
Were you making Orchestral Manoeuvres?
No. I used to play five-a-side years and years ago out in University College Dublin, and he used to come out and play every Tuesday night.
Right.
I thought the Belgians were bad for getting their boots. He forgot his shorts.
No, he was in the showers afterwards. He wasn't playing naked.
Right. Well, so there's plenty of celebrities you've seen naked, but we're not going to talk about Ron Jeremy right now. Smudger 23.
Well, on the subject of that bongo, I'm wondering how many people are going to pay to watch you and Sven on Saturday, because if I wanted to see loads of hot, sweaty, athletic Eastern Europeans on the internet, I wouldn't pay the subscription to what you're presenting.
Right.
There are other avenues one can explore.
Hear what you're saying, Barry. Hear what you're saying. Smudger 23 claims to have seen both Peter Stringfellow and John Motson naked, although sadly he says not at the same time. Right. Roy A1, I like the suggestion made on another blog recently that it was actually the woman on the Humber Bridge who talked Phil Brown and the Hull team out of
Yeah, I laughed at that. That was good.
Invisible Paris, thanks for that. We talked about that. Kovsky, the talk about Ipswich shows how celeb-obsessed the media are. If we were managed by Peter Andre, he says, we'd be all over this pod like a rash. You probably... be a bit higher up the league as well. Imagine if Peter Andre had been naked and managing Ipswich. That really would be quite something. Wango Kids, any chance for some information on Sully Montari and whether his Inter career is coming to an end? He had a bit of a rotten game last weekend, Montari, and the fans are on his back, and Mourinho's doing his usual thing of saying, well, he should be tough enough to take it. So,
and Port's thinking of Spurs as well.
Are they? Oh, all right, well.
I see the Inter goalkeeper, what's his name?
Julio Cesar,
his wife.
His wife, you know who his wife is?
Susanna Werner.
Yeah, who used to be Ronaldo's squeeze.
And a very attractive lady she is too.
He's denied, they were interested.
But she said in his blog that Manchester United were courting him.
Yes.
And he's had to come out and deny it, but I believe her.
Okay. Well, they may have been...
She looks very trustworthy.
Yeah. In other Italian news, Nerdy on your tweet, Sean, and Roti too posting and asking about Mazzari's appointment at Napoli. Paolo was saying on Monday that Donadoni was heading for the exit there. He's now been fired, left without any bitterness, which was nice, calling the president De Laurentiis a volcano who knows nothing about football. And in his place comes in Walter Mazzari, who's a lovely chap and has done well with various smallish scale teams, although Sampdoria won't thank me for calling them that. And I think, some people were saying, is this going to make a big difference to Napoli? Not really. I think, tactically, 3-5-2 and all of that, slightly more attacking, his mentality, probably compared to Donadoni. But otherwise, I mean, the other big thing about that was that he managed to have an argument with the president in his introductory press conference, which
not the best. But you know, we'll see how that all sorts out. PF10 making a good point. He says Donadoni has officially been sacked about bloody time too. However, they shouldn't have sacked the general manager Pierpaolo Marino, who is without doubt one of the best transfer gurus around. And as evidence, PF10 cites Hamzik, Lavezzi, Santa Croce, and many more. All very decent players who Napoli have found at bargain basement prices and are now sought after by big clubs all over the place. One other little bit of Italian news, just quickly, is to say that this there's a big story at the moment is that Milan may indeed be up for sale to the president of the Albanian Chess Federation, Rizzato Tacchi. I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong. He's also an oil magnate, having done a bit of an Abramovich with the national with the Albanian state oil reserves when they were privatised. He got them cheaper, apparently, and as says he's got £700 million ready to buy Milan from Berlusconi.
How is this thing? See, yesterday the Italian Parliament, I think, voted.
Oh, stadiums.
Berlusconi is no longer immune from prosecution.
Yeah, that's a big
shenanigans
one,
he got up to while president. Is that going to affect him? Is he going to end up in the jug?
No. Right. I mean, he's not. But he's always had, to be honest, allegedly the reason he got into politics was to avoid the many court cases that were pending against him. And last time I looked, which was some time ago, he had over 50 court cases, queuing up and circling around Biggin Hill, ready to land on his desk. But it's a big thing, that, because the last time he got into government, the first law that his government passed was one criminalise a form of illegal bookkeeping, which one of his companies was in the dock for doing, which he passed through immediately. It is, your first priority when you take charge.
You should make a joke at this point that Berlusconi, unlike the president of the Albanian Chess Federation, does have a checkers pass.
Oh, we should do. So, anyway, and the thing is, the other big news about Berlusconi is the fact that his company, Fininvest, have just been ordered to pay, and probably quite short notice, €750 million an industrial compensation case to one of his big business rivals, De Benedetti. So that's a lot of money, even for Fininvest, and it could well, the theory is, force his hand in terms of shedding one or two assets, particularly an asset like Milan, which he apparently isn't that bothered about spending any money on. Now, speaking of ownership and et cetera and all that, finish off today with a quick nod to one or two events in the English game. We've got the Football League meeting today to discuss the whole fit and proper persons test, which is relevant to the cases of, well, Notts County, Leeds, of course, and QPR, Flavio Briatore. And the verdict on that may well be out before this pod reaches you listeners, so you'll excuse us not really discussing that. We'll maybe leave that till Monday. But in the meantime, at least the confusion around Portsmouth has been cleared up, or has it?
No, it hasn't.
No?
Well, no, it hasn't. I have no idea who owns Portsmouth anymore.
This fellow, Ali Al-Farraj.
Suleiman Al-Fahim, appears to have, who I'm not sure even owned Portsmouth at all, now appears to have sold it on to this man you speak of, another Saudi Arabian multi-billionaire, I think he is, as opposed to just multi-millionaire. But no money has changed hands, and Al-Fahim has retained 10% of the club and will be executive director or something.
Five, I think, but for what it's worth.
Can I just say that they have, I think, given a public backing to Paul Hart and said that they're going to stick with him in the short term at least. And I think that's a good thing, because I think he's done a good job there. Despite their poor run of results, the poor performances have actually been very good. And there's definite signs there that with a bit of stability and maybe even a bit more investment, he can get them back up the table.
Well, the two things that have apparently materially happened since the arrival of latest Saudi Ali Al-Farraj is that A, the players have been paid, and secondly, Avram Grant's arrived to reoccupy the position of technical director, I think, is that right? Director of football?
It is. Redknapp, Harry Redknapp, in the Sun today was saying what a great thing it was because he's well connected, he'll be a person to lean and cry on and
he'll
talk
bring
to.
A bit of joy to the an otherwise depressed Portsmouth locker room.
Harry Redknapp should really keep his lip buttoned, because it's largely his fault that Portsmouth are in the mess they're in the first place.
Mm.
So he should probably just butt out.
How is it his fault?
But all the players he bought, the huge wage bill he ran up.
Yeah, but if the chairman says the money is there, I mean, he's not looking after the books. If the chairman says, yeah, we can afford this, he's going to say, okay, good.
Hmm. Again, it's a fair point. I can see both sides of that delicate issue. Perhaps Portsmouth fans would like to have their say on the post, www.guardian.co.uk/footballweekly. That's about it. I say about it, but Sean Ingle won't let us go, won't let producer Pete get to his appointment without first mentioning the hot topic of debate in streets and clubs up and down the land, England's 2018 World Cup bid.
Well, I think it's slightly interesting because it's been rumbling on for years and years, but there's the bid will be announced in December, and Jack Warner yesterday voiced what a lot of people have been saying privately, that England's bid, England are massive favourites for this, isn't perhaps going as well as it should be. I mean, he called the FA's bid lightweight, lacking aggression, and also, most bizarre at all, said that they didn't use the Queen enough.
Mm.
But I mean, you can imagine what Prince Philip would say, you know, going around all those non-white countries across the world. He'd probably end the monarchy with his various things. But I do think, England are favourites, but they haven't perhaps done enough in the last year or so to really push through politically, and they may not end up, they may well do Chicago come the bid in December.
Right, okay, the city, not the musical number. Okay, Warner also complaining about the fact that nobody was handing him out little bags when he arrived at Heathrow.
Goodie bags, but the Australians and the Qataris did.
At Heathrow?
Not at Heathrow, but before the conference they were at yesterday.
Oh, didn't they?
There are an awful lot of jokes you could make about Jack Warner being handed bags, but I'm sure our lawyers would rather we didn't.
Yep. Our lawyers certainly would. Now, that's it then. But thanks for that, Sean. It is a very interesting point, and one we're going to be following with interest. More than slightly interesting, I would say. Thank you anyway for joining us today, and you did brilliantly on your 20 minutes of research. Barry, coasting through as ever. Out partying the night before the exam, but still sails through with honours.
I wish.
And Paul Doyle. Fantastic stuff. Thank you, producer Pete. Good luck getting to your appointment. And you, listeners, thank you for doing the hard part as ever. We'll be back on Monday.
Football Weekly, in association with SportingBet.com.